Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider news, DevOps trends, and AWS insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. It's March 27th, 2024. I'm hosting this call from Beijing, China. So if any connection issues come up, that's why. But you're in good hands. Matt Calhoun here and Yanni will take over and guide you through the rest of the session. So real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for funded startups and enterprises that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. We do this by using our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. No matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your startup launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation and nail your value delivery every time. So if you'd be interested in booking a session with Cloud Posse, just go over to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz. Answer a few quick questions and we'll we'll set up a meeting to go over your situation. So if you are joining us for the first time, you can always sign up for Office Hours Live by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. Our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like, ask questions, and if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And we'll be posting a recording of this session to our office or to our YouTube channel on at youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. All right. With that said, let's get into some announcements quickly here. First one is an interesting plugin for VS Code. It gives you a graphical interface for visualizing and configuring GitHub Action workflows. What I think is interesting about it is the potential for more of these types of visual enhancements to complex workflows inside of an IDE like VS Code. For example, yeah, I could imagine it'd be pretty cool to have something like this for Atmos. And stack configurations to visualize the relationships between imports or things like that. This is doing this for GitHub Actions. Haven't used it personally, but I'd be curious, how it works in practice. Next announcement. Well, first technical glitch here. All right, well, that takes me to the next one automatically. So this was an interesting thing. It's obviously a promo for Cast AI, which offers optimizations for your spot workloads on, for example, Kubernetes or in general AWS. It's like spot.io. But what I thought was interesting about this was a live real-time graph of interruptions, basically instances being taken back by the various cloud providers. So in this case, US East 1 being AWS and US West 2 or US West 1 being AWS. So right now, 20% of instances are being jacked, are being taken back, which seems like a really high number. I'd be curious, to study this over time. It'd be really cool if you could have a slider with to adjust the time period so you could see over time how these things are impacted. Matt or Yanni, any
Yeah,
thoughts on this one?
I was just gonna comment that I thought it was interesting. I mean, I guess it makes sense, but their most highly utilized data centers have the most interruption. So if you want to run, it seems like if you want to run spot instances or go find a one of the less popular data centers, and you're less likely to have a problem with your workloads being interrupted, particularly if network latency isn't a particular concern on your application. That seems like a good plan.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point. If only like federated Kubernetes was a little bit easier and like, or could be handled automatically with, well, I guess you could do this pretty easily just using Carpenter if you don't care about your control plane being in the same region as your nodes.
Yeah.
It looks like GovCloud is a pretty safe bet. 0%
It's
interrupted
probably,
nodes.
I don't know, is Spot supported in
Is
GovCloud?
Spot
It
available?
might not
I
be.
don't
I've
know.
never actually checked that, so I don't know.
Yeah. Anyone know more about that? Is Spot supported in GovCloud?
I'm assuming not
No.
because of the requirements of, like, you have to have certain instance tenancy and a bunch of other things like enabled in GovCloud, so it doesn't seem like it'd be available, but maybe.
Yeah.
What does that percentage rate mean? So does 19% mean, because it said 24 hours in your graph. So does that mean if you have an instance like over the past 24 hours, like one in five instances, if it's 20%, get interrupted, they get a spot interruption. Is that what the percent means?
That's a good question. I don't know.
That's how I read it.
Yeah. For that period of time. So over the last 24 hours here, yeah. So I think that's a correct assertion. I think I know what's going on because I shared my full screen when I did the. I think this is some new behavior in Arc. Not sure how to get back to my slides without reopening them. All right, let's try that. All right, so next one would be this was a really interesting read to me. And I think I had vaguely recalled some of this history, but it is not entirely realized. So Redis was started by an independent developer many years ago by, what was his name? Forget. Yeah, by Italian developer Salvatore Antiris Sanfilippo, and was independent for a long time. One of their biggest kind of commercial users was a company called Gargantia Data, and they ultimately ended up hiring him on board. And I'm not sure what transpired, but ultimately he ended up signing over all the IP to this Gargantia Data. The author of this article doesn't go into details of that, and it sounds like it was not like an acquisition or an acqui-hire, or it didn't sound like really any significant amount of money exchanged hands for doing so. Gargantia, actually, just prior to this, had tried to rebrand as RedisDB, but respected the will of the author not to do so. Later on. Without listening to the author, they end up just going forward and anyways rebranding as Redis Labs. So Gargantia ends up now holding all the IP to Redis, and now many years later has decided to change the license of Redis to a source provided license, so no longer open source. One of the largest contributors to this project, Redis, has apparently been Amazon through Amazon ElastiCache. And now, I guess it's interesting, what's going to happen with Redis and how many more days it's going to be before a major fork is announced. And if Amazon, is such a big, user of Redis through ElastiCache Redis and has experience with doing open source commercial forks like this, like they have with OpenSearch and Elasticsearch, it seems like this is all but inevitable. Any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I know that there was I don't have the references in front of me. I should have pulled it up thinking, because I think they were talking about this, but when the original developer left, I remember there was like a whole write-up about how he was leaving in their hands. They talked about how it was going to be open source forever and a bunch of other things. So this feels
Really?
like yet another rug pull on the open source community out there. And then in a second related thing, I saw, I think it was today, I saw early this morning that Microsoft released some project that says it's
Yeah.
a remote K value KV store product. I didn't actually dig into it to see if it's a replacement for or if it's Redis compatible or if it's a replacement for Redis. I'd be curious to see what that is. I just haven't had a chance to dig into it yet.
Yeah, I forgot. I added that to the our internal Slack for office hours, and I forgot to announce that one. As I recall, it spoke the Redis wire protocol. I wasn't sure if it was a complete re-implementation of Redis. Presumably not, if it was more for key value store, strictly key value store.
Yeah. Plus, they already
Yeah.
have Azure Cache or whatever it is, which is their hosted Redis
Yeah.
service too. So, yeah, I don't know.
As well as please. Yeah. That is what happened. All right. Yeah. Next announcement would be let's see here. Visual Diffs. It's a nice little CLI tool called Difftastic, written in Go. This is not a alternative to using diff. It does not produce anything but graphical diffs. So use it, where appropriate. But it is nice to be able to have the visual syntax highlighting in context and not just a strict line-based diff that you get with a standard diff tool. So, for example, if you're familiar using GitHub and you're looking at the diffs there, that's more kind of like what you can do with Difftastic and see what changed. Here you can see without a screenshot. I think cover that one, cover that one, this one. So we, oops, something wrong with my link there, maybe. Nope, there it is. So we talked about Devon last week, which was a, I forget who is backing that project, which was the AI coder that can iteratively open pull requests and improve code. This is some project by GitHub itself that will be able to automatically remediate certain kinds of vulnerabilities by opening pull requests using AI functionality.
Yeah, I haven't tested it, but you said that in the future tense, but GitHub claims that that's available now as part of the advanced security package for
Oh,
GitHub.
really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
So I
I
haven't
didn't
tested it. Like I said,
realize it was
I don't know, but yeah,
okay, this is
look.
why I it was it's a beta, but I guess it's a GA then, generally available beta. But
Yeah, I guess
yeah.
that's
All right.
Century, right? Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. GitHub is launching first beta. Okay. Yeah. I just saw the line before where on the bottom it
Yeah.
says this new feature is now
Century
available
announced.
for all GitHub Advanced Security customers.
Huh. But I'm
See
curious
the
about
last
this other
line?
announcement. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, here it is. For all advanced security customers. I'm curious also what Sentry is doing in this area. I haven't been paying attention to recent features or improvements from Sentry. It's been some while, some time since we used it. I'll have to check that out. That's pretty funny. It's like 2:30 in the morning here for me, and I'm so tired. But I've been using Apple Vision for a while, And I just reached out to try and move a screen out of the way, reaching my hand out. So it's happening. That's pretty funny. All right. So this was reading a post on Reddit led me down a rabbit hole to finding CubeForm. The post that led me here was kind of asserting the failure of YAML with Helm and why it's difficult to use and hard to validate, and that most PRs related to Helm charts are about fixing templating formatting. And then somebody recommended using CubeForm. CubeForm is will take through STDN or presumably other sources, Kubernetes manifests and supports CRDs as well, and will validate those for you on the fly. So if you just generate, if you run Helm template pipe CubeForm, you can get a summary of, if it passes validation or not. Respondents weather map, we did that one. Podman, popular alternative to Docker desktop, I believe it's open source as well, has a new addition supporting a graphical UI for Kubernetes, which is popular in the Docker desktop as well. So a little bit more feature parity there.
Is it like for people who enjoyed Lens before they had their fiasco with open source and all of that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess you could say it's a lightweight Lens then in that case, but I mean, Lens did so much more. The Kubernetes graphical extension for Docker desktop is pretty light in functionality, but does make it easier to work with a Kubernetes-like API locally without a full-fledged Kubernetes cluster deployed. And then the graphical controls too.
I think Podman is really good for people in the Oracle ecosystem. If you look at all the what do you call it? There's Podman, and then there's the other open source project. I forget what it's called. It's like the, I forget.
Yeah, I
But
forget
all
all of
the
them.
It all the if you're using if you're in the Red Hat ecosystem, I guess this is relevant.
All right, I think that was almost the end of my announcements. What was the last one? Oh, yeah, just a small one. If you are on GovCloud now, it does have API support as well. So presumably a lot of that Terraform support that just came out for managing control tower and landing zones will now work for you in GovCloud. Presumably, not verified. All right, cool. We can get into some announcements. That's all I had, unless somebody else said something else. Or we can get into Q&A rather, now that we're done with announcements. No last announcements. Let me check the Zoom chat quickly.
The project, by the way, I was thinking of was Build A. Build
Oh, Builda.
AH. Yeah.
Yeah. Just Atlas operator. What was the Atlas operator? Or that was last week. Never mind. Continuous chat history here. All right. So let's go into Q&A. So Alex, I think you had just signed off last week. But we started answering the first question here on database migrations. Alex, did you get a chance to listen to that recording or what we
No, I
discussed?
haven't had a chance to catch up on that yet.
All right, I'm sorry about that. we started and
All
I checked.
right.
Oh, crap. You're not. All right. And then Matt Gowie, are you here today? Let's see. No, Matt Gowie. So we'll
Yeah,
skip that
I think if we're gonna
debate.
do that though, we should plan that ahead, like not just impromptu
Yeah.
do that on a on a
All right.
Q&A thing.
All right. And let's see. Hans, we also talked about the GitHub Enterprise one last week. So I don't know if you had a chance to listen to that, and I don't see you're on here. So yeah, all right, it's a open mic. Any questions we can get answered on the call today. Oh, there was one more here that we never got to. Could be pretty old. Anyone running production workloads on ECS Fargate Spot? If so, how are interruptions being handled efficiently? I don't have any specific things to add to that.
Yeah,
No.
I think I was just going to say that this is actually a common question, not just for ECS Spot, but I'll just say Spot in general. The best workloads to run on any kind of Spot instance is a workload that does like periodic checkpoints and can restart if interrupted. If you have very long running tasks, Spot is probably not the greatest. Like very long running tasks that cannot be interrupted without starting over again, Spot is probably not the best place to run that. I think that that's one of those things that you should run things that can run, be interrupted, have written their progress so far, and can pick up when they spin up on another. On another node, once they, the spot interruption takes place. We've had a couple of customers recently that have been bitten by this,
Very recent.
and
Yeah,
yeah, and we're working to try to write up some really good recommendations for them. But evaluating the workloads that you run on there, understand how those work, and then maybe better architecting the workloads to run on spot is your ultimate, is your ultimate way to make this efficient for you because, just taking any arbitrary workload and throwing it on spot is not you're going to run into surprises. I'll just say that, and you won't be successful in the long term running it that way. Or if you do, you're just getting really lucky.
Yeah, it's basically like live chaos engineering. Like,
One
I've
thing to also note for Fargate Spot, well, ECS Fargate Spot, because ECS Fargate doesn't have any spot, is that also performance is at times significantly lower. AWS doesn't have enough capacity for Fargate, so Fargate Spot gets at times older instances. I
Really?
don't have any data, but it's known that they are slower. And I don't think ECS natively supports replacing Spot with on-demand, but I could be wrong on that. I haven't looked at it in a while. And but yeah, there are interruptions. A lot of them happen at the top of the hour because a bunch of folks launch cron jobs at the top of the hour using ECS Fargate, which is hilarious. And keep in mind that normal on-demand ECS and savings plan might also be a very great and efficient way of doing stuff if you cannot easily do spot.
I never considered the impact on cron jobs with spot availability. That'd be pretty funny. Yeah.
It's I can speak from a actual like the last place I used to work at, we were a CI/CD company and we actually had customers builds and we were using Carpenter, which is if you're on EKS, that's your I mean I guess your only option for it. Okay, it's evolved a lot over its the project's life cycle. But it's now really, really intelligent when it comes to setting up workloads. And we couldn't obviously run customer builds on spot instances because you can get a 2 minute interruption, right? But you have a 30 minute customer's build. And that's really bad because it's probably an extreme example. Most people on this call probably don't work for a company that is a CI/CD company and runs customers builds, but they probably have similar requirements potentially. But the problem is like even if one build gets interrupted, the customer absolutely notices. But it's not an all or nothing thing. By moving to Carpenter, all of the workloads that we're able to run on Spot, so the actual application, like the API and all the microservices, they're running on Spot, and the customer bills are running on demand. And that actually had a huge impact on cost. So it's never, definitely not all or nothing, but I'm curious, because I actually don't have much experience with the ECS Spot, like the ECS Fargate Spot. The Carpenter gives you a lot of flexibility saying, I want to run it on this instance family. If that's not available, you know, run it on demand. And if that's not available, run it on Spot. So it has like a lot of logic to finally find that right fit for your workload and do that. I actually don't know what the deal with ECS is, if it's nearly as flexible. And if it's not, then that's actually a big reason to use EKS instead of ECS if you're planning like new infrastructure.
Keep in mind that the original question was about Fargate, which is one instance per container or pod or whatever. So choosing you're not using EC2, so that's not the problem.
Yeah. So this tool here is not helpful, right, Vlad, on my screen? Because this was like instances, EC2 instance back and forth between demand and Spot.
Yeah, no.
So this does not, yeah. This does not relate to Fargate.
Yeah.
All right.
Not related to Fargate. Again, I fully acknowledge that. Like they have they have the thing that's called like Spot Fleet on ECS, and that's the thing that you define like all of your like parameters.
Capacity provider. Yeah. Various capacity providers. So you could have multiple capacity providers, one for demand, one for Spot. And then
They have EC2 fleet, they have Spot fleet. And then you can monitor events. You can take event bridge, event bridge actions get raised when they give you their 2-minute warning that they're going to do that. So you can start to change capacity and on demand if you need to, a bunch of things. The only thing that bugs me that I've done some complicated things with that is that the 2-minute warning that they're going to kill the thing is a best effort. It's not a guaranteed SLA. So lots of times you're trying to do something if you get the 2-minute warning, but you never get the 2-minute warning. They just pull the node from you, and then you're like, oh, node is gone. Now I have to take action, you know, based on that. So I think that there's definitely room for improvement on ECS for this, you know, this specific thing, but definitely when you get into ECS Fargate, it's, you know, you have far less control over how that all happens. So that's why my original answer was really only fix your workload so that it can be interrupted. Like that's really the only viable solution on ECS Fargate, in my opinion, at least. So if it gets interrupted, it gets interrupted, and it will hopefully pick itself back up within a couple of minutes.
The issue on the screen that Eric is looking at is the containers roadmap request to automatically fall back to on-demand when there's no spot capacity. It's big, it's not yet done, but folks share a bunch of ways to work around it. Usually it's a Lambda. Like, hey, if this service deployment, whatever, doesn't have enough capacity, bump up the desired number of containers for the on-demand one.
Yeah, and that was exactly what I was, that was kind of what I was alluding to with the event bridge things, is that you get a bunch of event bridge notifications when all of these things happen. So you can take action on those using Lambdas or other, you know, other things to scale your on-demand workload if you need to.
All right. Good discussion there. Oh, one thing I wanted to announce. I forgot to do it last week, so it's too late now. You can watch the recording. But Pepe, longtime member of our community, flew out to Paris last week for KubeCon and presented at OpenTofu about the future of Atlantis. If you're using Atlantis with Terraform, OpenTofu, it's an interesting talk to watch. And Pepe always adds a lot of interesting things when talking about it and his experience. So check that out. We'll share a recording. We'll share the link to the YouTube video on that. You can catch up on. Let's see what else. All right, any other questions that we can get answered today? Feel free to post it in the chat if you can't join with audio. All right. Matt, Yanni, any good material?
No, I was just going to say a side note. I wasn't going to mention it, but the funny thing about the cron jobs running at the top of the hour and causing issues for availability for other users, it's actually a thing that in the GitHub documentation, it's such a phenomenon with cron in general that if you look at the GitHub actions documentation, actually GitHub says if you're going to make a cron job, don't make it run to top of the hour. We recommend doing it like 5 minutes after.
If you want it to be at any sort of a predictable interval, basically.
Yeah, because they have the same thing as AWS, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I ran into this really early in my career. I worked with a very experienced like system administrator slash engineer that he would always schedule all his cron jobs at these weird things, like 7 minutes past the hour and 56 minutes, you know, past the hour and all these things. And I would always, like, I first was like reviewing his code and I was like, this makes no sense to me. Why don't you just make it on the hour if you want it to run every hour? And then he finally explained it to me, like, well, if everyone does that, then your systems are going to get overloaded with all the jobs running at the same time, like on the hour. And I was like, oh, well, that's a pretty interesting phenomenon. But I'm surprised there's no, like, you know, maybe like a tool to figure out if there's a way to like balance your cron jobs running on any, like on any system. Like, you know, I wanted this to run all on, you know, in like sometime hourly, but you figure out like when is the best time to run it. You know, that would be interesting.
Yeah. I thought there was some way you could like add some jitter to it automatically. I know sometimes the trick is you just add a random sleep and that's another way to do it, but that doesn't really help ensuring a guaranteed execution time. That just means after execution sleeps a random time, which saves your system some time, but wouldn't help in this situation. I just thought that there was a way that you could do that, but I guess there isn't. Any other questions? We are just killing time here.
I've got one kind of opinion question. What do people think about the choice between using remote state in Terraform and using data to pull in outside resources?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me reiterate the question and then let's get into answering it because it's something we've been thinking about a lot lately. So the question is, in your Terraform, if you need to get the state of some other piece of Terraform code, how do you use remote state, or what are some other options to doing it? What are the pros and cons with using Terraform's remote state as well? So to be clear, when you use remote state in Terraform, it is actually a data source, just like any other data source. It's just that this data source knows how to read whatever backend you've configured and read some path from that backend and return the outputs of that Terraform root module. So we've been using this for a long time at Cloud Posse. I think we early on drank the Kool-Aid that this was the best practice. to be dry in our components. And we learned a lot from it. And I think we're making some changes that Matt Calhoun can talk about. So why you might want to do this is, you know, when you first start doing Terraform, and we talk about this in our write-up on Atmos and the Terraform limitations, is you start with a Terraform root module. That Terraform root module starts very simply, and then it grows and grows and grows, and then it becomes what we like to call a terralith. That terralith, you know, is convenient because you have the state of all the resources within the same scope that you want to access. But over time, becomes more brittle, and plans take longer and longer, and you'll experience more failures as a result of that happening. So using Terraform Remote State is a great way to decompose your architecture into smaller and smaller pieces. And we talk about this here kind of as one of the stages of progression. I think it's even after, you know, stage five, it's probably, I guess we didn't even talk about componentization. That's, I guess, much later on here. That's what we do at Cloud Posse, is this componentization of our Terraform. And when you do that, you create these smaller, loosely coupled root modules. But you introduce a new problem. And that problem is, how do you share the state between these loosely coupled root modules? That's where Terraform Remote State is a very effective way of doing that. We started doing a lot of that at Cloud Posse when we started breaking out our root modules to be deployed across multiple accounts and multiple regions and so forth. The first thing you'll encounter is it's hard to know which bucket that state is in, what path in that bucket that state is in, and it puts a lot of the burden on the end user to use the data source for accessing remote state. So the first thing you'll probably want to end up doing if you take that approach is to create a module that will resolve the state backend for you to pull it up. So that's what we do in some of our components. We talk about that pattern, I believe, in our Atmos documentation, even by search for remote state, Terraform component remote state. So what's interesting is with Atmos, for example, we have this, you know, abstraction in YAML that lets us describe the configuration for every single root module, every single component in your architecture. And then our Terraform provider for this knows how to read that. So we also know where to find your remote state for Terraform. And I think it's a very elegant solution for the situation, and you know, evolved organically in what we do. One of the problems, though, is you can only read that remote state now in Terraform. You can jump through hoops and parse the JSON if you want to in other languages and so forth, but it's not as convenient as using something like a key value storage. So we are making a change in our architecture to abstract away how you store that state into something we call KV storage. And Matt here, maybe I'll pass it over, who can talk more about the problem and what we see as the solution.
Yeah, honestly, I think it's a simple solution to a complex problem. Like we've decided that rather than publishing, you know, all of our, or having all of our state and reading all of our state as the interface for modules to share data with each other, we thought it would be much better to implicitly select the interface, essentially, like what things like each module wants to publish, and, you know, out of it, and then store that data in some sort of a key value store, and then have all of your other modules that need to consume that data read it from the key value store from a known location. And I think that it sounds simple, but then I think the biggest challenge to, you know, to remote state is that it's in a particular account in a particular, if we're talking about like AWS, it's in a particular account in a particular you know, S3 bucket and uses a particular DynamoDB for locking, and it makes you jump through a lot of permissioning hoops to share that data. So the thing that we're working on, the solution that we're working on, is essentially a generic key value store that can have pluggable backends. So you can choose what you or how you want to store the data on the backend. And then we're also working at the same time on some replication solutions to replicate that data that is published out of particular modules to multiple accounts, multiple regions, et cetera, so that it's really easy to read that shared data without needing highly privileged credentials to the entire Terraform state, you know, backend for doing so. So it's a project that we've thought a lot about and designed a lot about, and we're just in kind of the implementation phases right now. So we'll definitely have more to share about it, and, you know, coming up in the future.
Yeah, one thing to add to that, that became a little bit more apparent after we implemented some versions of this, is that it almost borrows against some of the concepts in object-oriented programming, where you have private, protected, and public, you know, variables or functions. So in this case, Terraform state is a lot more like exposing private variables, you know, protected arguably, but private in this sense. In this model that we're proposing or implementing right now, this is more like giving protected or public variables, depending on how you look at it, public to your account or your organization, maybe.
That makes sense. Yeah. So I was
just going to add one more thing, that it's really like, I think in my mind, the real difference is that each module developer explicitly, or in this case, you know, a component, a root module, they explicitly opt into what should be shared out of their module. They say, here are the things that we would like to let other people share, like use from our module. Yeah. And then you go that way. And then if you change your internal implementation or anything like that, you don't affect any other modules that rely on your, module. Because like, it isn't, the resource name didn't change, the output name like isn't different, like whatever, you're still publishing. Like it's essentially like the API contract from your module. You're saying, I'm always going to publish a thing called foo out of my module. And as long as you read foo from the KB store, you'll always get foo. And how that gets there is like up to the module developer. And then finally, the one other thing I'll say is that this also gives you the ability, if you use this method, it gives you the ability to have non-Terraform things participate in your Terraform ecosystem pretty easily. So as long as another tool, so let's say you had like a bunch of things created in Pulumi or CloudFormation or Control Tower or like any of these other things, as long as the resulting action of those things running is that they also write data to a KV store, to the same KV store in a well-known location, then your Terraform can use that data as well. It doesn't need to be provisioned in Terraform to be able to use it. So if you need the CIDR block for a VPC that was provisioned by Pulumi could still like publish that the same way, and your module is none the wiser if it uses this KV store to read that CIDR block that was provisioned some way other than Terraform. So that's the other benefit we get to doing it this way. So I just wanted to finish off the answer. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Andy. So
no, that's great. That's really interesting. Yeah. Because I mean, so I've been doing some reading on this, trying to find opinions online. And I guess a couple of the reasons some people are recommending data elements over remote state. And I guess to be clear, right, we're talking about if I've got a VPC that's not part of my root module, I can pull that in through the, you know, data AWS VPC and then get all the information that I need out of it just through AWS credentials without having to read anything specific to Terraform. And they're talking about things like if it wasn't built in Terraform or if it was built by another team and you don't have access to the state file. And I guess more granular permissions using like IAM, you can give people access to resources without giving them the ability to read your state file. So interesting stuff there. I like the abstraction layer. I guess I'd be concerned about how hard that would be to implement, especially when you're talking about other teams that are building infrastructure that you need to access.
Yeah, as long as you, so if you're talking about our solution, I think we've taken that, like we're trying to take that into account as part of this whole thing. And as long as everyone agrees on a central location to write data, it works like really well. I think what you'll find with the approach that you just talked about, the data source like lookup approach, is that for sure you're going to get a good way mount, like down the road and be able to do a lot of things that way. And inevitably what you're going to find out is that you're going to come to a data source you're going to come to a point where a data source doesn't exist to look up the thing that you need, and or you don't have a way to canonically look up the thing that you're trying to look up because you don't have enough like context to do it. And then you're going to come up with something like, well, now we have to come up with a tagging strategy that we put on all of our resources so that I can always know that I can retrieve this thing with this tag, which gives me the instance that I'm looking for. And it gets really, really complicated to try to do that for, you know, this is, if you look at that, like the progression of Terraform maturity that Eric laid out before, I think you'll find you're going to hit the same thing with this, because you're going to get through the hello world things and you're going to be like, this is great. You're going to get down like three or four levels. And then like on the fourth level, you're going to be like, oh man, I have no way to do what I'm trying to do. How am I going to do this? And you're going to have to come up with some hack where you either have to hard code things and you're not dry anymore, or you're going to have to come up with some crazy like tag scheme that makes it so that you can look up all of those things. And it's neither is a great solution to it. So we've been down this path a bunch of times. It's it's not easy to solve.
Yeah,
Matt, do you want to dig into the back end, some of the back ends that we're playing?
Let's let Andy respond though first.
I think it makes sense. You know, it was interesting. We ran into sort of the other side of the problem. At one point, there was a Terraform remote state that a bunch of modules were using to pull data about some common resources. And that Terraform module had been essentially abandoned by the team that maintained it. We had this state that looked fine, but was gradually drifting farther and farther away from what was really in production. So like, that's one of the risks of using the remote state, is if the team that's managing it is not keeping that up to date with what's going on in the real world, you're going to get that drift. Whereas pulling in the data element, you know, you're getting the actual, like the state of what's really in the real world.
Yeah. So that's the benefit, is you get that real time state. But to Matt's earlier point, that only solves that situation when you're only needing to get that state. What you're going to find is you're going to need more and more other kinds of information, or distilled information, or one, like who's the leader? And, you know, well, I guess you can set that as a tag, but then you'll start adding more and more tags perhaps to this and those tags. Yeah. So, mileage may vary. Matt?
No, I was just going to touch on Yoni's question, is that if it wasn't clear before, what the way that we designed this is we have a unique common set of actions where you can set values or get values basically out of it. So you use the same interface for it all, but then we have we're working on swappable backend so that you can have a backend in essentially like S3, SSM Param Store, DynamoDB, We're working on Artifactory as one of them for a customer of ours. Google and Azure Cloud, yeah, their storage equivalents on the back end. So things like CosmoDB, et cetera. So the idea is that the interface is the same for using this module or this, you know, this method of writing, reading and writing data. But the back end that actually stores that data can be swapped to something that makes sense for your organization. So if you have like, you know, AWS Secrets Manager, all over the place, like you would just enable the back end that for that, and you wouldn't need to dictate like we're going to use S3 or we're going to use SSM parameter store or something like that. Or if your organization has a, you know, a vault or a console, you know, implementation, and you want to store the properties and data in the back end there, that you can follow the same model. And the whole idea is that the interface to the modules looks exactly the same, but the back end of where it stores it is pluggable or swappable. So yeah, we're working on that. Like I said, we'll have some in the very near future, we'll have some announcements around that. So, and we can demo it maybe on one of these calls, like how it all works.
That's cool. So is it going to be like a Terraform provider that you send your outputs to and it writes them, or is it going to be tied into Atmos?
It's a Terraform module that you'll use to do that. And essentially, because the interface is exactly the same, it'll be a series of Terraform modules, basically one for each Terraform provider out there. So there's like an AWS flavor of the module. There's a GCP flavor of the module. There's an Azure flavor of the module. There's an Artifactory flavor of the module, and you can opt into that. But the interface and all the way that you use the module and the variables and all that is identical. So you just pick the one that your team wants to use. So like you would pick the AWS flavor and then enable the AWS secret store backing store version of it through configuration. And basically then all the rest of them would be turned off. So like, but if you wanted to use parameter store instead of secrets manager, you can turn on parameter store, turn off secrets manager kind of thing. And then that would be used as the backend storage for you. So we've done all the architecture and we're just starting the implementation now. So, well, we're pretty far. I shouldn't say we're just starting, but we're in midst of the implementation now. We have we've been having pretty good luck so far with making this work.
How is the use going to look like? Is this just more Terraform code that I add to my existing modules and tell it what outputs to store?
Exactly. Yep. Cool. So basically, you just call the module and you say set, and you give the key value pairs that you want to set. So set, you know, foo equals bar, baz equals bat. And then if you're in our, you know, ecosystem and you're using kind of like our whole context TF and all of that kind of thing, mm-hmm. It's also context aware. So it will automatically derive the location, like the location in the key store where it should write that stuff for you, because it knows like about your context. So it will automatically like create a key path for you, if you will, of where to store all that data. Overridable, of course, but like it will do that by default. So you can, the simplest usage is literally instantiate the module, like module source equals, you know, the module name, set, and then open up a map and say, key equals value, key equals value, key equals value, and it will just get stored for you in the well-known location. And then the opposite, when you need to retrieve data, is you just say get, and you can then specify like where you need to get that from, like what the module, the other module's name is that you need to get the data from, and it just retrieves it for you. So it's pretty well thought out, pretty simple to use. If I do say so, as I was part of it, I'm somewhat patting myself on the back, but it's I found it to be pretty simple so far in utilizing it.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm excited to see it.
What's cool about the parameter. So for example, if that's the backend you're using, I think you somebody mentions before, maybe it was Matt, is allowing things that are not Terraform to read from it. Parameter store is a good example because Eric, do you remember Chamber, or does anybody on the call know the CLI tool Chamber? Sure. It's like you can actually, you just want to search it up quickly on GitHub, maybe anybody who hasn't seen it before or not, but it's just like a, if depending on the backend you're using, you can imagine, for example, you have Terraform creating a EKS cluster and you need to know the OADC URI. You don't have to be a Terraform configuration or like an Atmos component or a Terraform module to actually be able to read it. Like you can have things that are cross-plane, for example, creating an IRSA role for the using that OIDC URI. Or for example, you can create all of your ECS clusters using Terraform, using Atmos, whatever. You're writing to the KV store. And if it's parameter store, you can have maybe another team is not using Terraform. They're just writing or they're just writing the raw ECS task definitions in JSON. It can reference the parameter store by the path. So it gives you that interoperability out of Terraform. And the other thing that's really cool, depending on the backend, is that a lot of these, like this remote state, sometimes it bleeds into the area of secrets. So depending on your backend for this KV store, if it's a secret, that's appropriate as well. Because sometimes you're reading it and maybe it's a sensitive data. But if you have parameter store, it natively has support for a secure string and whatnot. So,
all right, let's pause there for a moment. I do want to get to one last question. He's been waiting patiently. Mr. Jimenez asks, any tools for or best practices to stop credit card testing, to start like scammers from using your credit card checkout process to test credit cards? This is a really common problem. We've had customers affected by this. Basically, you know, they target smaller e-commerce sites that have a checkout process, maybe without as much validation, and they'll run through, you know, 10, 50, 100 orders and just trying different credit cards until one works. And then they know that card works and they'll go use it to do other things. These are often small transactions, especially if you offer some, you know, REST like API that your front end uses to do those things, they'll script that and exploit it. So I think one of the most common things you'll see companies use for this is just sticking Cloudflare in front of it and ensuring that you have the bot detection there that'll do JavaScript challenges. This will eliminate the vast majority of these types of attacks. Now, even anything can be bypassed these days, but you want to make it not worth their time and effort, and that's a great way. AWS WAF now has some of the same kind of capabilities, so you can do JavaScript challenges on clients that appear to be headless.
I think you might be still sharing Chamber. Not sure if
you wanted to. I'm not sharing. I'm not sharing anything.
Oh, okay.
I'm not intending to share anything. It was so the question I'm answering is in the Q&A on Zoom.
And, okay.
Adel, I don't even want to mess it up. So, Mr. Jimenez, I'm sure if that answered your question.
Yeah. Sorry. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I hear you just fine.
Okay. Sorry. It's Adelaido. So yeah, we're leveraging Cloudflare right now and the bot detection rules. Just we have the business plan. So whatever out of the box bot detection, that's what we're leveraging, but we're still seeing a high number of transactions coming in, or high number of requests.
Are you able
with credit card testing?
Do those tests correspond also to your predominant customer locations where you should be receiving valid transactions?
No, so we've investigated. So they're using VPN. They're doing high VPN, so high level of requests coming from different locations almost every second, basically.
Yeah, my point is more like, so for example, if most of your traffic is in the US and you're seeing this international, you can raise the level of challenges basically that you have for other countries. Now, if they're coming from VPNs, Cloudflare has support for identifying certain VPN traffic, especially VPN traffic from any of the established VPN providers. Now, if they're using like malware, botnet, I'm talking too loud here, botnets to get there, that's going to be harder to track down. Do you know more about those VPNs that they're using?
I don't we just know it's potentially a VPN because they're basically making the user agent is the same, but they're making requests from totally different IPs
Lots
every
of
second. So different
interesting.
from what we're noticing, it's like different countries, different areas, and so it's kind of hard to kind of mitigate. We implemented some rules, but it mitigated the issue for a few months, but then they came back with a more sophisticated kind of bot or automation kind of scripting or
Have
whatever they're using.
you reached out to Cloudflare support themselves? I'd be really curious what they do, because I mean they must see this day in, day out. So they'll probably have some really good insights, especially if they can look at your that same traffic and identify the patterns.
Okay, yeah, I'll reach out to them. I haven't actually reached out to them, but I think that's a good point. I'll probably open up a support ticket for them.
Because that's like their main CTA on their landing page. I'm under attack, right? So
Okay.
that's where they make their money. All right.
Cool.
Well, we are at time. I want to be mindful of everyone's schedule today. We ran way over. So gonna wrap things up here on office hours. Also before I get kicked out of the lobby here. If you guys haven't already subscribed, please join us on YouTube. Go to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. You'll find today's episode as well as our back catalog of all past episodes there, as well as our podcast. It's a syndication of Office Hours. So every one of these segments we also publish on our podcast. Go to podcast.cloudposse.com to subscribe to that. If you're interested in working with Cloud Posse or seeing if we can move the needle for you, please go to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz. And you'll get to book a session with me directly and go through your situation, see if we can help you out. Thanks, everyone. See you all next week, same time, same place. Have a great rest of your week.